Anyone walking through the countryside in the northeast of Cologne near Odenthal along the River Dün will not realize at first glance that a castle once stood here. It once stood proudly on a hill in a bend of the river. Well, to be honest, you really can't see it because the grounds of this castle, located in the immediate vicinity to the south of the Altenberg Cathedral, are a nature reserve and it is forbidden to enter. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a real nature reserve. But even if you were to hike here, you would have to look closely. Only a few mounds and buried quarry stone walls here and there provide evidence that a medieval castle once stood here. The castle of a dynasty that rose enormously here in the immediate vicinity of Cologne in the 12th century and was to have a decisive influence on the history of Cologne. The rise of the Count of Berg dynasty, which named itself after its ancestral seat, began here at Burg Berge, Castle Berg. How did the rulers of Berg become so powerful and important for Cologne? We will find out that in this episode. First of all, the intermediate position of the territory of the Berg dynasty, or as between the Electorate of Cologne, so the Archbishopric of Cologne, and the Duchy of Westphalia, which was also ruled by the Church of Cologne, would remain characteristic for centuries. This caused constant friction, but also for interesting alliances in the region at times. Without the Lords of Berg, Cologne and its citizens would not have been able to develop as it did at certain points in the history of the city during the Middle Ages. First and foremost in the later Battle of Worringen, but spoiler, we are still a long way from there. So let's start from the beginning right after the intro. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows, from the Romans up until our present time. Archbishop Anno II had triumphed. He, in 1060, he had finally defeated the Count Palatine, Henry from the House of the Mighty at Zonitz. Wait a minute, did I really just say Anno II? We already covered him in 4 episodes of this podcast a long time ago. With the defeat of his rival in a feud here in the second half of the 11th century, Anno had taken a huge area from the previously ruling at Zonitz in the region. Virtually everything to the right of the Rhine near Cologne, from the Ruhr area down to the Siebenbürger mountains near Bonn. And it was precisely this land that needed new owners. After all, the victorious archbishop could not be everywhere. So he did what medieval regional rulers always did. He granted fiefs, so he gave property to nobles he liked, who then administered and owned the property on his behalf. To put it quite simply, the noble family that we would later know as the noble family of Berg is also said to have taken a slice of the right bank of the Rhine. Or maybe, does the trail to the dynasty of Berg lead even further back? As early as around the year 1000, some historians suspected that the reigning bailiff of the Deutz monastery, a man named Hermann, who had a brother named Adolf, was an ancestor of those we would later know as the noble family of Berg. Because the name Adolf, in particular, was a name that many of the House of Berg would bear. You'll see that in a moment. Oh, really, you will see that. And since in Deutz, the monastery, you could only become a bailiff, so the administrative secular administrator, the manager, so to speak, if you were of noble birth, the idea is not entirely far-fetched. So the noble family of Berg, as a long and proven vassal of the Archbishop of Cologne since the time of Archbishop Heribert around the year 1000, we don't know. There is simply a lack of historical evidence to clarify this definitely. Until then, it remains pure speculation. And here we have it again, the lack of written sources that can provide us with historically clear statements. Something we have already suffered from several times in this podcast in the task of presenting Cologne's city history in the best possible way. So let's get back to the facts, back to Anne II, where the noble family of Berg becomes more tangible. As you know, Archbishop Anno had an enormous amount of power in the 1060s. The cunning Swabian had disempowered the powerful noble family in the region, the Itzonids, in several military conflicts. At the same time, he had kidnapped the young King Henry IV and held him in his power. Anno was thus able to comprehensively reorganize the right bank of the Rhine around Cologne. He was able to redistribute the territory of the Itzonids, as well as royal estates that were also located in the region. With Henry IV as his hostage, the Archbishop of Cologne ruled de facto as regent of the empire for the time being. A young nobleman named Adolf is likely to have stood out as a particularly loyal ally. Anno must have enfeoffed him with territories on the right bank of the Rhine that he had not previously owned. Also, at an unknown date, this Adolf married a noblewoman named Adelheid von Laufen, who was the heiress to numerous possessions that lay directly north of Adolf's own possessions on the right bank of the Rhine, close to the river Wupper. A jackpot for Adolf. He had three sons with Adelheid. The younger son, Bruno, even became Archbishop of Cologne as Bruno II in 1131 to 1137, while the eldest son of the same name succeeded his father as Adolf II. I know the name Adolf might sound funny if you look at the more recent history of Cologne, but hey, that's not Cologne, I mean of Germany. But hey, that's the name we have to stick with in this episode. It's the name that they gave all half of their children, literally. The middle son also embarked on an ecclesiastical career and became abbot of a monastery. But here too, there are insufficient historical sources, and the question remains as to when exactly Adolf I became a count. This is not entirely clear. We won't know for sure until 1101, at the end of Adolf I's life. In an imperial charter of Henry IV, Adolf of Berg is clearly attested here as Count of Berg. Much remains unclear to this day about the presumed founder of the noble family of Berg. Adolf and his family's ancestral seat was the castle from the intro, the Castle Berge. They then renamed themselves Counts of this castle, so Counts of Berge or Counts of Berg. Berg in German means so much like a mountain or a big hill, and it might be really the deal back then. The castle stands on a big hill at the river Dün, so that's why it was called Castle Berg, so Castle Mountain. Adolf I, as I said, who cannot be fully traced historically, died in 1106, and his son of the same name took over the leadership of the dynasty of the Counts of Berg. As always, at such a time, we do not know exactly when this Adolf number 2 was born. Probably in the 1090s, so he was still very young when he took office, but he was also granted a comparatively long life, because Adolf II will reign as Count of Berg for no less than 54 years. This period also saw the rapid rise of the Rhenish noble family, and even his death is not fully documented, because in 1160 he did not simply die, but he just hanged up his boots and spent his remaining days in a monastery that he himself had co-founded, or at least he had made it possible. The location of that said monastery, just a few steps north of his old family castle, the Burg Berge. The Cistercian order, still quite young at the time, was invited to build a monastery here in 1133. But how were the Cistercian monks to build their new monastery and church in this remote location? And, you know, Cistercian monks like to settle in remote places so that they could better fulfill their spiritual duties and not be distracted by worldly matters. Well, Adolf II gave the Cistercian monks his family castle when he founded their monastery in 1133. He gave up the castle and left it to the Cistercians. They then used this castle as a residence first, but then they gradually demolished the building to gain building materials for their new monastery building and church, of course. The location of the old family castle was no longer quite ideal for Adolf II. He had also married strategically like his father. 1120, he had married a daughter of the Count of Arnsberg. He had also acquired further territories to the north in Westphalia, above all Altena and Hövel. And I know many of you guys may have never heard of these places before. I will try to find a map and show you all the places I mention here in this episode. But to put it simply, the territory extended further north along the Rhine towards the Wupper River, which flows east-west towards the Rhine. A ruler, therefore, preferred to have his ancestral seat in the middle of his domain, and Burg Berge, Castle Berge, was not the ideal location anymore. Adolf II, therefore, chooses a place in what is now Solingen, a town on the river Wupper, as his family's new seat. He had a new hilltop castle built on a mountain. Logically, this is then simply called, in Latin, Novus Mons, so new mountain or new castle. And the old castle, Berge in Odenthal, 20 kilometers further south, where the Cistercian monks initially lived until their monastery was built, is now on the old mountain castle and thus gave the place its name Altenberg, so old mountain, up until today. The former abbey church that you can see here in Altenberg today, however, is a new building from the 13th century. Begun at almost the same time as the new Gothic Cologne Cathedral in 1248, it is still popularly known today as Bergischer Dom, so the Cathedral of Berg. And yes, due to the same architectural style, Altenberg Cathedral really does look like a much smaller but also stylistically simpler version of Cologne Cathedral. Fun fact, the foundation stone was laid by Archbishop Conrad of Hochstaden in both Cologne and Altenberg, another parallel between the two cathedrals in the immediate vicinity. But back to Solingen, to the site of the new castle of Berg. Called Novus Mons at the time, this new mountain or new castle in Solingen has also been given a new name over time. Nowadays, it is known as Schloss Burg, so as Burg Castle, and a popular excursion destination for everyone in the region, including me. It's a beautiful place, and I've been there many times as a child and as an adult. I particularly remember the events such as knights tournaments where you can buy wooden swords or learn archery as a child, and a delicious Bergische Waffe with cream and cherries for refreshment. And no, this is not an advertising block from the Solingen Tourist Board, but simply a childhood memory by me. But hey, if someone from that corner is listening, I wouldn't be opposed to that. However, historical purists may not protest at my enthusiasm for Schloss Burg, so Burg Castle. This is because the castle later lost its significance when a new main residence was built in Düsseldorf, and in this context it fell into disrepair over the centuries. By the end of the 19th century, hardly anything of the castle was left standing, a few outer walls perhaps. For a long time, the inhabitants are said to have used the site as a source of building materials. Who can blame them? But at the end of the 19th century, the population of the region had a change of heart. Voices became louder, not only to protect the existing ruins from further decay, it was to be completely resurrected, as a monument to the Bergische Land, the region of Berg. From 1819 onwards, the castle was rebuilt over a period of many, many years. In 1919, after several decades, this process was almost complete. But even later work continued diligently on the site, like extensive restoration work began in 2014. This mixture of romanticism and historicism, two very important trends of the time in the late 19th century, gave the castle a new life. This phase of the castle renaissance can be found throughout the Rhinelands. Many of the castles that you can see today on a boat trip on the Rhine were often rebuilt in the 19th century with a little more imagination and their own elements than being historically correct. Bourg Castle may not be completely historically accurate at every turn, which I personally don't mind at all. I'd rather have a castle that's not entirely historically accurate than not at all. Now, I really want to go there again. Well, it's summer's coming up, so maybe. But first, we have to go back to the 12th century, back to Count Adolf II of Berg. For Adolf II is not only good at marrying and building a new castle, he is also active as a general. He took part in the Second Crusade, which, like almost all subsequent ones, failed. Although he survived the failure of the Crusade, his son of the same name and intended heir fell in Syria, outside Damascus, in 1148. Politically, the territory of the Berg family borders the powerful Archbishopric of Cologne to the west, with the Archbishop of Cologne at its head. The ties between Adolf II and the city of Cologne and the Archbishop of Cologne were very close. Very, very close, in fact. Adolf's brother Bruno served as Archbishop of Cologne from 1131 to 1137, and two of his six sons later also served as chief shepherds of the Cologne church. Friedrich II reigned from 1156 to 1158 and thus died before his father, and Bruno III, who was around 20 years younger, held office from 1191 and stepped down as Archbishop of Cologne after just 2 years. But even when non-family members held the bishop's see in Cologne, relations were good. This also brought Adolf II another important office, which extended his sphere of power to the south. In 1138, he was granted the bailiwick rights of Siegburg Abbey. How did he manage this? His first wife had died in the meantime, and he had married the niece of Archbishop Friedrich I of Cologne. During the lifetime of Adolf II, the noble family of Berg had established itself as a powerful political force. Three times in the 12th century, they had provided the Archbishop of Cologne. The territory on the right bank of the Rhine had been extended from Cologne to the north and south. The zenith of this old Berg dynasty of counts had not yet been reached. But yet, two generations later, the male line would die out. Loyalty and proximity to Cologne, as well as holding the bishop's see of Cologne on several occasions, and a clever marriage policy had allowed the power of the Counts of Berg to grow enormously during the first half of the 12th century. When Adolf II entered Altenberg Abbey in 1160 and withdrew from public life, his son Engelbert I, not to confuse you with Engelbert I of Cologne, the archbishop, but father of the son of the same name, with whom we are already familiar and would be that Archbishop of Cologne, took over the rule, so Engelbert of Cologne's daddy. Thanks to another good connection with the emperor, especially Emperor Barbarossa, Engelbert is awarded further properties in the region on the right bank of the Rhine as a fief from the emperor in gratitude for his services and loyalty. Binsberg, with a strategically important castle on a mountain, also falls to his family. Likewise, Windeck Castle, which extended his domain to the southeast. For anyone unfamiliar with the area, said again, I'll try to show all of this on a map. Engelbert also extended his influence to the north, as far as today's Wuppertal and along the Rhine River near Hilden. In the east, the same with Hückeswagen. Engelbert I is also active as a patron in domestic politics. At the new ancestral seat, Schloss Burg, so Burg Castle in Solingen, he donates a chapel to the Knights of St. John's. Loyalty to the emperor paid off for Engelbert of Berg. He owed him numerous donations, pledges, fiefs, and the granting of rights that extended the territory of his rule to the north, east, and south. But his loyalty was also his downfall at the end. Engelbert I of Berg followed his emperor on the Third Crusade, 1 year before Emperor Barbarossa was to drown in a river in present-day Turkey during the Third Crusade. Engelbert died while passing through Serbia in 1189 and was killed in battle. When Engelbert I of Berg dies, the eldest of his two sons becomes his successor. And guess what his name is? Sure, another Adolf, the third one. Adolf III becomes the new Count of Berg in troubled times. The death of Emperor Henry VI in 1197 marked the beginning of the 20-year-long dispute over the German throne. For the salvation for us all, I will omit a summary and refer you to previous episodes which dealt with the topic extensively. It may come as no surprise that Adolf III, and yes, now it gets more even confusing, sided with the Archbishop of Cologne to whom he was related in the dispute over the throne. And this Archbishop's name again? That's right, that was Adolf of Altena. As a result, Adolf of Berg switched sides several times between the Welf and the Hohenstaufen dynasty as well, together with his relative Adolf of Altena. And he was lucky in the end. When the emperor, the future emperor Frederick II, began to assert himself in the German throne dispute in 1212, Adolf III of Berg had sided with the Hohenstaufen in good time and remained master of his possessions. This in turn enabled Adolf's younger brother, Engelbert, the Engelbert we already talked about in the previous episode, to become the new Archbishop of Cologne. As already mentioned in the last episode, a powerful bloc had thus formed on the Rhine. Engelbert of Cologne as the Archbishop of Cologne and Adolf III of Berg. Two brothers, the powerful rulers, the noble dynasty of the Counts of Berg had reached its zenith. But then tragedy struck. Adolf III had already distinguished himself as a crusader in 1212. Together with his younger brother and others, he had fought in southern France against the Albigensians, who were considered heretics in the eyes of the Christian majority at that time. But what is better than taking part in one crusade? Right, taking part in two crusades, thought Adolf III. As a participant in the Fifth Crusade, he set off with his army from Binsberg Castle to the east in 1217. And the plan for that Fifth Crusade was, how to say it nicely, really, the ambitions were high, so to speak. First, they wanted to conquer the Nile Delta and from there, whole of Egypt, and only from there did they want to move north to the Holy Land to recapture Jerusalem. Think big, I guess. The strategic city in the Nile Delta at the time was the Egyptian city of Damiet. The Crusaders conquered the city in 1219, suffering heavy losses. However, Count Adolf III of Berg did not live to see this. He had died a year earlier during the siege of the city. An epidemic had carried him off to the dead. Only one child from his marriage to a woman named Bertha had reached adulthood and was alive in 1218. This daughter was called Irmgard and was therefore, as the only child, the heir to the county of Berg. And who had Irmgard been married to since 1216? To Henry of Limburg, one of the great rivals of the noble family of Berg. The marriage, which had of course been arranged for political reasons, had probably brought no improvements in the relationship between Berg and Limburg. Quite the opposite. And Engelbert and Adolf had also considered dissolving the marriage between Irmgard and the Duke of Limburg. However, it had been postponed until after the Crusade. Too late, however. Adolf III had died now during the Crusade. This meant that the County of Berg, already a duchy in terms of size and power, and its numerous possessions now fell to Irmgard as heiress, which she loudly demanded. However, this meant that Duke Henry of Limburg, who was married to her, would also become Count of Berg, and the line would continue through her children and the House of Limburg. With successful military campaigns, he set himself up as administrator of the county, but then made a peace treaty in 1220 with the Duchy of Limburg and stipulated that the County of Berg would only fall to the House of Limburg upon Engelbert's death. I don't know what Engelbert thought, that maybe he could find some other heir because he was not allowed to have children and proclaim this child his heir. No, not at all. And his death, as we know, that was not far off. Archbishop Engelbert's violent death in 1225 at the hands of Friedrich of Isenberg, the husband of Duke Henry of Limburg's sister, marked the end of the first Berg dynasty in the male line. Theories therefore persist that Duke Henry of Limburg was actually behind the murder, who finally wanted to acquire the Berg estates. From 1225, Duke Henry of Limburg also ruled as Count of Berg. The House of Limburg would itself rule the country Berg possessions until 1348. The region of Berg and the numerous places later came under the second dynasty of Berg's rule owe them an important heraldic element in their coat of arms, the Lion of Berg. Only that this lion was actually once the Limburg Lion. Over time, however, the lion was adopted for the County of Berg. During a quick search, I found over 80 towns or districts alone that still have the Berg Lion today in their coat of arms. Today's city of Düsseldorf has it in its coat of arms, an upright red lion with a double tail and a crown on its head, the characteristics of that Berg Lion. The important chemical site of Leverkusen has it, and above all many districts of Cologne that lie to the right bank of the Rhine and thus in the former territory of Berg have it. Mülheim, for example, which was an independent town until 1914, has a particularly active lion in their coat of arms. The lion stands on a boat together with a skipper and rows along diligently. It's really funny. Look it up on my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. The same goes for the former towns of Rodenkirchen in what is now southwest Cologne and Porz in the southeast of Cologne, which were incorporated into the cathedral city in 1975. I told you so. If you want to shed light on Cologne's history in a comprehensive way, you can't avoid the County of Berg, which would even become a duchy from 1380 onwards. And with Engelbert of Cologne's death in 1225, we have arrived at the current chronology. Let's take a little break for a drink. As the title of this episode shows, this was now largely just the history of the lords of Berg. But what was it actually like in the countryside, the territory of Berg? Well, it was very diverse. The areas that borders almost directly on the Rhine are still relatively flat from the countryside. However, the further east you go, the terrain rises. Here is the Rhenish Slate Mountains, which close off the Cologne lowlands to the east. You have no idea what the Cologne lowland is? Then, dear listener, you probably need to listen to the very first episode of this podcast again. While Cologne is around 50 meters above sea level, here in the territories of Berg, it can be up to 500 meters in peak in the east. And you can probably guess without highways, Autobahnen or railroad lines, the territory of the dynasty of Berg was poorly developed in terms of infrastructure until industrialization. There were no large towns until the early modern period, as was generally the case throughout the Middle Ages. People in the countryside lived in small settlements. Neighboring Cologne, the largest city in the empire, must have been like a trip to the moon for some people from Berg who visited the city on the Rhine. The lives of most of the people who lived here were shaped accordingly. Most of them were farmers who ran their own farms and produced almost all the goods and commodities they needed on a subsistence basis in small settlements or farms. Grain was grown to make flour and bake bread. Some livestock was kept to provide meat and milk, but also as a means of labor. In addition, almost every inhabitant was beholden to a local nobleman, so being a subject. This meant that, in addition to an annual payment of goods to the landlord, you also had to work 3 days a week, so almost half the year, for the landlord on his farm. Now, I don't want to use the familiar clichés of the so-called dark and evil Middle Ages. the system must have worked in this way over the centuries, but co-working on your own farm and then on the landlord's farm at the same time meant one thing above all for the people of Berg. It was a hard, exhausting life. On the other hand, it also created a breed of people who knew how to survive and, of course, how to celebrate life when the opportunity arose. It may be a little bit like a spoiler, but without the strong peasants from Berg, Cologne would hardly have been able to shake off the archbishop's rule in a city as far as possible at the end of the 13th century. We have already touched on what made the Duchy of Berg so special in the last episode and also in this one. It lay almost directly between the core areas of the Archbishopric of Cologne on the left bank of the Rhine, with the city of the same name, and the Duchy of Westphalia on the right bank of the Rhine. If an Archbishop of Cologne wanted to go to Arnsberg, for example, the center of the Duchy of Westphalia, he always had to travel through the county of Berg. The first Berg dynasty of counts, with the numerous Adolfs and Engelberts, had therefore always sought close ties to the Cologne church, and in the course of this, family members had themselves been elected as Archbishop of Cologne 4 times already. They were aware of the strategic importance of their own domain, but also that they had one of the most powerful princes in the empire as their direct neighbor in the Archbishop of Cologne, so it was better to be on good terms with him. The House of Limburg, which took over the county in 1225, was to continue on this course for the time being, but this would change later onwards, and already would change at the very beginning, so to speak, but that's not important for our story here. But it would definitely change at the end of the 13th century. Why? We will come to that, of course, in the corresponding episode. Now that you know about the history of the county of Berg and its squeezed position between Cologne's territories, you are a little better equipped for the further history of Cologne in the 13th century, or as the alternative title could be, the long road to the Battle of Worringen in 1288. The County of Berg. We have already touched on its significance for Cologne several times here. Roughly speaking, you can say, with the exception of Deutz, everything on the right side of the Rhine was once under the control of the county and then Duchy of Berg for centuries, and also parts of southwestern Cologne on the left bank of the Rhine, including Rodenkirchen. This makes up about 2/3 of the current city area and population in the 21st century. What happened to the county of Berg in the aftermath of Engelbert? Well, Duke Henry IV of Limburg would rule Limburg and Berg in a personal union until 1246. After his death, this personal union was abolished. His younger son became the new Duke of Limburg. The elder son, out of the fourth, became Count of Berg. He had already appointed the latter as a co-ruler of Berg during his lifetime. It was under this out of the fourth that the construction of today's Abbey Church in Altenberg began in 1255, but we'll leave everything else for another time. Next episode, we will be returning to the city of Cologne. I still have to see exactly what we are going to talk about when this episode comes out. I have been on vacation for some time beforehand, so I'll record the episode well in advance. Maybe we'll just take a look at what's going on in the city at the time. How are the patricians, the rich citizens, actually doing, for example, and who's in charge at the moment? Let's see. Many thanks this time to Norbert, Antje, Ute, Christian, Marcus, Uli, Frank, Stefan, Martin and Thomas for your tips via PayPal. I have no idea if I should pronounce your name in German or in English. I used the following literature, among others. Firstly, by Franz Gruß in a new edition by Klaus Herdepe, the Geschichte des Bergischen Landes, or the history of the country of Berg. Then, Die Herren von Berg, The Lords of Berg, by Hans-Jörg Laute, which is now somewhat outdated, but a good introduction to the topic. I also copied his title for this episode's title. By the way, if you listen to this episode directly on the release day, today is my birthday. Please give me a positive rating in the podcast app you trust as a small token of appreciation. I would be delighted. So, recommend me further, stay loyal to this podcast, and auf Wiedersehen.